Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, this is Ishleen. I'm the producer of the BBC World Service podcast, My Indian Life. And I just wanted to let you know that the whole of our second season is now available. From the story of the man who's desperate to be the first person on Mars, to the Kashmiri rapper making music under curfew. You'll find those and lots more brilliant stories from young people across India by searching for My Indian Life wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Friday, the 7th of February, these are our main stories. It's been confirmed that a Chinese doctor who tried to raise early concerns about the coronavirus has died of the disease. There had earlier been conflicting reports about Li Wenliang's health. A day after he was acquitted by the Senate, President Trump has verbally abused the Democrats who impeached him. And the leader of the German state of Thuringia has resigned after outrage at the way he won office with the support of the far right. Also in this podcast,
it seems to be not just the increase in temperatures, it's the extremes. So it may be that bumblebees just can't cope with these extremes of temperature.
Scientists say there's further evidence that climate change poses a massive threat to bumblebees in Europe and North America. It's been confirmed that the Chinese doctor who was one of the first to raise concerns about the coronavirus outbreak, Li Wenliang, has died of the illness. It follows confusion caused by conflicting reports about his health. The news was reported by the Wuhan Central Hospital and by state media, but official outlets later said he was still on life support. There have been suggestions these reports were ordered by government officials seeking to control the flow of information. Dr. Li has become a hero in China for his early warnings. He was initially summoned by police and told to stop spreading rumours. The head of the BBC Chinese service, Howard Zhang, told us more about the events leading to Dr. Li's confirmed death.
Initially, there was first a very close friend of the doctor who first filed a Twitter equivalent on Chinese Weibo claiming the doctor's heart had stopped beating. And very soon, all the state media, including People's Daily, also carried on their social media as well as on their main online websites the declaration that Dr. Wenliang Li is dead. And what followed was a outpouring of grief and anger on Chinese social media. One post, Global Times, I think, got over 700,000 comments within a few hours' time. One insider told us that because of this outpouring of anger and grief and really, really set officials back, they did not know what to expect and they wanted to control the situation. So an internal order, which we got a small copy of, is basically asking all media not to embellish and to really control what you report and to keep it to the minimum. And that was the initial order. But now, from one person told us, is after the death, the declaration of death, now his, basically Dr. Wenliang Li's body has been put on a resuscitation machine. And some expert told us that this machine can keep a person's body, essentially keep it there for weeks if they want to.
He is considered a hero. We saw from this outpouring of grief, the response to the Weibo postings, he is considered a hero by many Chinese people, isn't he?
He was hailed as one of the brave eight initial health workers from the city of Wuhan raised the alarm over this new coronavirus, and they were all told off by local authorities not to spread rumors. They were all told to sign a letter saying, you know, we told non-truth and we should stop spreading rumors. Most people said that basically he's becoming one of those symbols of national grief.
The latest figures are that 28,000 people in China have been infected, more than 600 have died. And the BBC has managed to get a rare interview with a health worker in Hubei, the province where the outbreak originated. Yao, she asked that we only use her family name, works in blood analysis in what she described as the fever clinic in her hospital. It's been designated by the authorities as one of the centres for dealing with coronavirus. It's in Shangyang, which is about 300 kilometres northwest of Wuhan. This is what she told Tim Franks.
I've been working in the fever clinic over the past few weeks, taking blood samples from patients who have fever and are suspected of having coronavirus, analysing them and screening the results. It's a hard job with high risks, given how contagious the virus is.
How many people have you tested who have had coronavirus? Are you seeing more and more cases?
Yes, we do see the numbers increasing. The population of my county is just over 500,000. At the beginning of the outbreak, we were seeing some 300 to 400 patients per day. But since we introduced the triaging system, not only confirmed and highly suspected cases will be sent to me. I've seen 66 patients today, which is still quite high. In total, there are 46 confirmed cases in my county so far. We'll probably see more in the coming days.
Have you had all the equipment and all the support that you've needed since the start of the outbreak?
We were caught off guard initially and have been lacking medical supplies. For now, I think we're fine with equipment, because many companies have made donations to us. But there is a shortage of protective surgical masks and suits. The hospital has been trying their best to make sure that we have sufficient supplies. Because they say we are the soldiers on the front line, we can't fight without weapons. So we do feel supported by the government and also by the people. Many people have sent us warm messages and even food and other daily necessities. I feel that even though they are quarantined at home, the virus brings our hearts together. None of the medical staffs in my hospital is infected, but the situation in Wuhan city is far worse. From what I know, many doctors and nurses are infected there.
Just to be clear, though, you're saying that there's been, from the start, a shortage in protective equipment for medical staff, for the frontline workers such as you. Does that mean that you're a little bit concerned about the possibility that you might become infected?
I'd be lying if I told you that I'm not concerned. There are 27 members of staff in my department. Two are doing my job. Actually, I have already booked a train ticket to Guangzhou to spend the Chinese New Year there with my family. My kid and my mom went first, but then the epidemic broke out, and the situation just became more and more tense every day. So I decided to cancel my ticket, and I volunteered myself to the fever clinic, because I thought, other colleagues have their families here. With such a contagious disease, you never know if you're carrying the virus back home. I'm here on my own. If I go, then they don't need to go. So I think it was a sensible decision. Yes, it's true that we all live one life. But there was just this strong voice inside me saying, you must go. So I told myself, be prepared and protect yourself well. Even if there was no protective suit, I could always wear a raincoat. Even there was no mask, I could ask friends all over China to send one to me. There is always a way. The reality turned out to be much better in terms of supplies.
That was Yao, a health worker in Hubei. Medical workers in Hong Kong have gone on strike, demanding a full closure of the border with the mainland. The authorities are refusing to go that far, but have said that they're imposing what they describe as a mandatory 14-day quarantine on all visitors from mainland China. From Hong Kong, here's our correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
Across the other side of Hong Kong's Victoria Harbour from where I'm standing, I can see a huge cruise ship called the World Dream lying at anchor. Well, it's not much of a dream for the 3,600 people on board, because they are all now in quarantine. At least 10 people on board the ship have been confirmed as being infected with the new coronavirus. It's adding to the already high sense of anxiety here in Hong Kong about the growth and spread of this viral outbreak. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, again bowed to public pressure. From Saturday, she said, all people crossing the border from mainland China will be quarantined for 14 days, regardless of whether they are mainland Chinese, foreigners, or Hong Kong residents. For some, this is still too little too late. They want the border closed. One is Professor Ho Pak Leung from Hong Kong University.
The reason is we are not ready. If there is a sudden and massive increase in the number of infections, our healthcare system will collapse. We don't have enough surgical masks. We don't have enough diagnostic reagents. We don't have enough intensive care support.
In central China, that is exactly what has happened. It is now 2 weeks since the lockdown of Wuhan City was declared. But the situation there has not stabilised. Reported infections and deaths continue to climb rapidly. On Wednesday, I managed to speak to a number of people in Wuhan by phone. They all told me a similar story of sick people unable to get to hospital and of people dying at home without treatment or testing. This young woman, surnamed In, told me she has relatives working in one of the city's hospitals.
Hospitals have no beds, so if you get sick, you have to stay at home and look after yourself. A lot of doctors and nurses have come from other parts of China now, so the situation is better, but there are still no beds for patients.
Others spoke of growing food shortages, of anxiety, and of not knowing what to believe. Ms. Yin said she doesn't believe the government figures for infections or deaths.
Of course, the figures are not correct. People who died at home are cremated immediately, and those deaths are not being counted in the statistics. And there are also people who die in hospital who have not been tested, so they are not counted either.
It is clear the epidemic in China has now spread well beyond Wuhan. The question for Hong Kong and the rest of the world is, can the virus be contained in China, or are we on the verge of a full pandemic? There are worrying signs from Hong Kong and Singapore, where so-called community transmissions appear to be happening. Professor Keiji Fukuda used to work for the WHO and the Centre for Disease Control, and he now advises the Hong Kong government.
This kind of scenario that we're seeing unfold now is certainly one of the potential ways that we've imagined that a pandemic could start. Our biggest concern has always been a respiratory virus. The concern about this virus really does center around the fact that it may be highly transmissible through the air. You know, many of the components that we've imagined could happen are happening right now.
With the world now potentially facing a new viral pandemic, there are still many questions to be answered. How does the virus spread? How dangerous is it to healthy people? What drugs may be effective? And what about a vaccine? Right now, all of these questions remain unanswered.
That was Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Hong Kong. In other news now, President Trump has launched a tirade against his enemies a day after the Republican-controlled Senate voted not to remove him from office over charges of trying to force Ukraine into investigating his political opponents. Speaking at an annual prayer breakfast in Washington on Thursday, he said the impeachment trial had been an ordeal and added that such an experience shouldn't be allowed to take place again. It was a message he was to repeat more vehemently afterwards in the White House, and the vindication he maintained was absolute.
They took nothing and brought me to a final vote of impeachment. That's a very ugly word to me. It's a very dark word, very ugly. They took nothing. They took a phone call that was a totally appropriate call. I call it a perfect call because it was. And they brought me to the final stages of impeachment. But now we have that gorgeous word. I never thought a word would sound so good. It's called total acquittal. Total acquittal.
Our Washington correspondent is Aline Makboul.
He spoke for 62 minutes. It was entirely unscripted. And, you know, he said at the beginning it wasn't a speech but a celebration, and that's what it looked like. It was extremely raucous. Republican Party members, his family, his supporters, all cheering him on. And yes, in terms of the language, he lambasted, he insulted Democrats and those who accused him. He called them dirty people and sleaze bags and scum at the FBI at one stage he was talking about. And no sense at all that he felt he'd done anything wrong. There was no sense of remorse. There was no apology for any of his actions. And this was going on in the East Room of the White House. And, you know, it struck many that it looked very much like a campaign rally inside the White House.
And it wasn't just about draining the swamp, as it were. It wasn't general anger against the people who had impeached him. There were very personal attacks.
Really personal attacks. I mean, he's been talking, you know, this was always likely to be the outcome of this impeachment process, that he was going to be acquitted. The danger always was for Democrats that he would use this as a sort of moment of victory and a rallying cry. And the reason it was so inevitable, of course, according to some Democrats, is that, you know, when you go against Donald Trump, he does attack you. And so the feeling was, in a Republican-led Senate, there would be a few Republicans who would want to stand up and say, OK, all of this evidence is here that he, in a sense, in effect, blackmailed Ukraine with all this military aid to start this campaign into Joe Biden. And we saw a little bit of that already today, some payback for anyone who stood in his way. He particularly was talking about Democrats, but also members of the FBI who'd been involved in the Russia investigation as well. So very much setting the tone, I'm sure, for what is to come in the coming weeks and months as we lead to the election.
That was Aline McBall in Washington. We hear a lot about the decline of bee populations and various theories about why it's happening. Now, scientists writing in the journal Science have produced further evidence that climate change is responsible for a sharp decline in bumblebee numbers in Europe and North America. And there are fears that if current trends continue, there could be a mass extinction of bumblebees within a few decades. Our science reporter is Helen Briggs.
They looked at populations across Europe and North America, and they found that the likelihood of a bee being found in any given place on those two continents has declined by about a third since the 1970s. Now, we know that bees are under threat from all sorts of factors: pesticides, habitat loss, climate change. But this is the first time for bumblebees that they've really been able to tie it to climate change. And they think that actually declines due to climate change have been worse than we thought. And it seems to be not just the increase in temperatures, it's the extremes. So it may be that bumblebees just can't cope with these extremes of temperature. Now, they can, of course, move their range. So they are moving into cooler areas, but that's not enough to make up, to compensate for the losses.
And how important are bumblebees? There are lots of different kinds of bee, obviously, but how important are bumblebees to our ecosystems, to food production and so on?
Well, they're really important. 250 species of bumblebee out there, and they do a lot of work pollinating food, pollinating crops, pollinating wildflowers. And without them, then it does mean that it would change the face of the landscape, and it could put certain crops at risk. We wouldn't be able to grow them so well. So they're doing a very important thing. They also provide food for other species, of course, not just for humans, but they're food for birds and other animals. So they're an essential part of the ecosystem.
And what particular kinds of crops would be threatened?
Well, particular crops like tomatoes, they're very important for tomatoes, for squashes, and all sorts of things like that, and wildflowers. So we really do need them. And now they're calling for much sort of larger studies of bumblebees, because we know quite a lot about them now, certain continents, North America, Europe, but other places around the world, they haven't been studied in such detail.
And just finally, you mentioned that the bees are migrating to cooler areas. Does that just mean that the agriculture of particular crops and so on would be able to move too?
I think it's a question we just really don't have the answer to. And it seems that some bee species can actually adjust their range, but others can't. But if you get to the point where they just biologically cannot cope, it's sort of far beyond what they've evolved to cope with, then they won't be able to survive. But the real point is that even though some are migrating, the overall effect is a massive decline in many species that they looked at.
That was Helen Briggs. Still to come in this podcast.
One of them came up after about 6 weeks, the one we call Methuselah. She switched to using fresh water.
The scientists in Israel who say they've managed to grow an ancient species of date palm from seeds thousands of years old. Israeli police say they've shot and killed a Palestinian who opened fire on officers in Jerusalem, lightly wounding one of them. Tensions have risen since President Trump announced his proposed peace plan last month. Tom Bateman reports from Jerusalem.
The gunman was killed by Israeli security forces at one of the entrances to the Old City, close to the holy site known as Haram al-Sharif to Muslims or the Temple Mount to Jews. Tensions have been rising in the days after President Trump announced his so-called deal of the century, which Palestinians see as an effective surrender document. During clashes and raids by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, three Palestinians have been killed in 24 hours. While in Jerusalem, an Israeli soldier was seriously wounded after a car drove into at least 12 off-duty army recruits.
That was Tom Bateman in Jerusalem. The border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which of course remains in the EU, will be of key importance during the post-Brexit negotiations. So who will lead Ireland through those talks? If the polls are correct, it's unlikely to be the current Taoiseach or Prime Minister Leo Varadkar. His party, Fine Gael, is lagging behind its historical rival, Fianna Fáil, which is led by the former Irish Foreign Minister, Micheál Martin. But Sinn Féin has been surging, with one poll this week putting it in first place. Both Mr. Martin and Mr. Varadkar have again said that they would not go into a coalition with Sinn Féin because of policy differences and its historical links to the IRA. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page has been following the campaign.
And I don't see any politicians reaching out to homeless people. Do you care about their vote?
Yeah, of course I do. I care about everyone's vote.
A prime minister under pressure over housing and homelessness.
The goal should be that we get to there, but we're not getting to there as we
are right now. I have been out with the volunteer groups and I've done that and I admitted that.
It's been perhaps the major election issue. The average rent has almost doubled in 7 years, creating a financial cliff edge for many voters. During the campaign, Leo Varadkar has tried to focus on the fact Ireland has the fastest growing economy in Europe and on his role in the Brexit negotiations.
Other parties talk about change, but we've been the ones that have been driving it through. I want to finish the job.
Taoiseach, you have a high international profile, but has your handling of Brexit actually given you any advantage in this campaign? Because all parties in Ireland basically agree on the approach.
Yeah, I suppose that remains to be seen, and we'll find out on election day. The message that I am trying to put across really to, you know, Irish farmers, our fishing communities, and also the 200,000 people who work in industries and in jobs that depend on trade with the UK, is that Brexit isn't done yet. And I'm asking them not to take the risk of moving from the team led by me and Simon Coveney to another team involving who knows who.
A strong Ireland is an Ireland that gets off the sidelines and helps Europe to move on from Brexit. Thank you very much indeed.
Micheál Martin's party, Fianna Fáil, has been in opposition for 9 years since it took the blame for an economic meltdown. As a former foreign minister, Mr. Martin says he's more than capable of dealing with the upcoming trade talks.
Micheál Martin, can I ask you, what difference will there be in terms of approach between you and Leo Varadkar? Why do you believe you would do a better job?
Well, fundamentally, there has been a national consensus on Ireland on Brexit, and all parties are united in terms of the core national objective. And obviously, zero quota, zero tariff trade with Britain. We would like a trading relationship between Europe and Britain that would approximate as closely to the current situation, because anything else would be damaging to the Irish economy. We also believe it would be damaging to the British economy.
Both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are, broadly speaking, parties of the political centre. Dr. Teresa Reedy, an analyst from University College Cork, says there wouldn't be much difference in how the men would tackle the next stage of Brexit.
Whilst there are occasional disagreements on matters of style, in terms of the substance of the issues, it's unlikely to change. The past is tricky for both leaders. It's tricky for Mr. Varadkar because he's been in government for 9 years, but it's tricky for Mr. Martin because he was in the government during the economic crisis.
And so the biggest left-wing party claims only it can offer a genuine alternative. Sinn Féin's in power in Northern Ireland, but for years now it's also wanted to be in government in Dublin. Its leader Mary Lou MacDonald says the party's priority would be to pave the way for a united Ireland.
Particularly younger people, they've said this Irish unity project is exciting because it gives us the opportunity to fix things that are broken right across Irish society. But above all, people want to know that their government, particularly in Dublin, is leading the conversation, that we need to do it responsibly, thoughtfully, inclusively, and we need to start that process.
The Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, ending that report from Chris Page. The leader of the central German state of Thuringia has resigned a day after being voted into office with the support of the far-right AfD party. Thomas Kemmerich from the Liberal Free Democrats has called for the regional parliament to be dissolved to allow new elections to take place. As our correspondent Jenny Hill reports from Berlin, the involvement of the far-right breaks a long-standing taboo in German politics.
Few Germans had heard of Thomas Kemmerich until yesterday, when he found himself at the centre of what's been described as a political earthquake. He was unexpectedly elected as Prime Minister of Thuringia, thanks to the support of AfD, which ignored its own candidate. It did so to oust the left-wing incumbent and cause chaos in the regional parliament. Mr. Kemmerich has come to embody the vulnerability of what the Germans call the Brandmauer, or firewall, a decades-long political convention that ensures no mainstream party works with the far right. Germany's Chancellor, Angela Merkel, described what happened as unforgivable. She rebuked regional politicians from her own Christian Democrats, who had, knowingly or otherwise, also aligned themselves with AfD to support Mr. Kemmerich. It's perhaps no surprise that thousands took to the streets of several German cities in protest. In 1930, Adolf Hitler's National Socialists had their first significant electoral victory in Thuringia.
That report by Jenny Hill. People have been eating dates for millennia. They are referred to in the Bible, and archaeologists have dug up pits or stones thousands of years old. Now a team of Jerusalem-based researchers say they've managed to grow an ancient species of date palms from 2,000-year-old seeds. These were dates that were much prized in their time, grown in big plantations around the Dead Sea. Sarah Salon is the director of the Natural Medicine Research Centre at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. Tim Franks asked her where they'd got the seeds from in the first place.
They were found by Israeli archaeologists in the 1960s who excavated Matsada on the shores of the Dead Sea. And it's the site of King Herod's famous palace. And the other seeds were found mostly in Judean desert caves around the Dead Sea. So I got those seeds from basically the Hebrew University. I went and picked them myself from the boxes all stored in musty old rooms.
And how old are these seeds?
Well, they range from about 400 before the Common Era to about 200 of the Common Era.
Okay, so
between around 2,000 years plus.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And you've managed to do what with them?
Well, I work in plants, looking at how historically a lot of the flora in this country was used for medicines. I got interested in what the species were that were no longer here, that are described, for example, in the Bible, these wonderful date palms that are mentioned, and people like Josephus and Roman historians and geographers like Pliny and Strabo coming here and describing these magnificent date plantations that produce this super alpha quality date that was exported all around the Mediterranean. And I thought, well, where are these date plantations? And of course, they were all gone. So I figured that would be interesting to try and grow some of these ancient plants. Now, where would you get ancient plants from? From ancient seeds. My colleague, Dr. Elaine Soloway, used techniques, she told us, fairly standard techniques that farmers use to wake up seeds. And then she put them in very fresh potting soil and watered them, interestingly, with the local water, which is very salty. And one of them came up after about 6 weeks, the one we call Methuselah. And she noticed that its leaves were looking very dried out and not happy. And so she switched to using fresh, fresh water, which is the water they would have had when they were growing by the Dead Sea, because those palm plantations 2,000 years ago were fed by freshwater streams, and then it revived beautifully.
So are you hoping that you will be able to use the pollen from Methuselah, as you've called this male date tree?
To pollinate our first female, who's called Hannah.
Yeah, understood. But at that point, could you say that the dates that are being produced are similar or the same as the dates that were produced 2,000 years ago?
No. We can only say that they are really ancient dates, because both the mum and the dad are ancient trees.
So Hannah also comes from an ancient seed.
That's right. We originally started with Methuselah, and then in this report in Science Advances, we've grown another six. And out of those six, we have two females.
Okay,
so if we get an ancient male together with an ancient female, then hopefully we'll produce an ancient date.
Can you imagine in the years to come there being plantations that have arisen out of these ancient seeds?
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah, that would be so lovely. That would be so exciting.
Sarah Salon, who is the director of the Natural Medicine Research Centre in Jerusalem. And that's it from us for now. I have an ancient date of my own to go home to, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.